Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to New Books in Performing Arts, a podcast from the New Books Network. My name is Andy Boyd. Today, I have as my guest Dr. Xiaomei Chen, the author of many, many books, including the one we're talking about today, Performing the Socialist State, Modern Chinese Theater and Film Culture. Dr. Chen, welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Andy, for inviting me. I really look forward to talk about this and have a dialogue with you.
Great. So one of the many projects that you've worked on was the Columbia Anthology of Modern Chinese Drama, which should be on everybody's bookshelf. It's an incredible volume. And I wanted to ask you, what did you learn about the plays that you published in that volume by seeing some of them performed by your students at UC Davis?
Thank you, Andy, for the question. As you mentioned, the Columbia Anthology of Modern Chinese Drama in the English translation has been used in English-speaking classrooms as a textbook to study modern Chinese theater, especially in the subgenre, which is the focus of my research called spoken drama, which is the Western-style drama learned or adapted from Shakespeare, Chekhov, Ibsen, and so on. So my anthology really aim at general readers who might be interested in the bookstore under the best plays of Shakespeare, 50 best dramas of Latin America. So I want this book to be on a bookshelf. People who want to learn the basics, the ideas, the history, and the text of modern Chinese theater would grab this from bookstore and read it. So this anthology covers 22 plays translated English, and covers the period of 1920 to 1990. So it's really the entire 20th century. In order for the general readers, as well as students in Chinese drama classes in the English-speaking countries to really understand the importance of these works, I have a introduction to the anthology, which has a cultural history of the century of Chinese drama and its beginnings and where the ends in this anthology in 1990. and also provide kind of a brief old biography of the major writers covered in this one. So for instance, my student, I said, okay, read Tian Han's this play. They have a little paragraph in the introduction that will actually tells you what Tian Han is all about, why this play was included. And also I provide a kind of a close reading, why this particular play of Tian Han is important, close reading of text to help students and general readers to understand the text better in the culture of the 20th century. So that's how I started the anthology. And I have been using this anthology to teach my Chinese drama class at UC Davis. And I want to test how this anthology is really accessible through performing some of the dramatic texts in American classroom by my student. So I give my students in modern Chinese drama some extra credit and say, hey, if you produce one of these plays, you get extra credit. So it started from the idea of motivating students to perform some of the favorite texts in the anthology, but end up really motivating them to organize a UC Davis Chinese Drama Club, which actually performed Chinese plays from this anthology in three seasons. And there's a 1917 season in which my students or the UC Davis Chinese Drama Club performed a play in this anthology by Ouyang Yiqian called After Returning Home. What's interesting about this play is that it was seldom performed in China, because who cares about 1920s Chinese student going to America and learn American culture, right? This is old text by dead guy, and it seems to be irrelevant. But amazingly, my students love the text, love the play, and they easily relate 1920 Ouyang Yiqian's experience in crossing the oceans and studying America as a young Chinese man. So both my students and the audience in the classroom, we didn't have money to rent a theater, so we staged it in a big classroom. They both relate to the relevance of 1920s Chinese students experiencing studying in America and the cross-cultural conflict and difficulties and the challenge. So I guess seeing students' performance of those old plays, dated plays, made me realize that there is a way of connecting students, and a good way to connect with students is to ask them to adapt a text into performance. In the middle of performance, not only they would have fun and have a peer kind of friendship, but also they understand the text so much better because it's related to their life experience right now.
I must imagine too that it was a very gratifying experience to see that these translations were very stage worthy and really worked as a live performance, not just as a text for reading and study.
You're correct. Yes, that's the additional aspect of that, to imagine some of the plays actually can be performance in countries beyond the Chinese territory.
Yeah. You've written many books about 20th century Chinese drama and film. How does this current book, Performing the Socialist State, build on those earlier books and extend the arguments?
Well, this is a very good question. So please allow me for a little bit detour to my first book, a 1995 first book, Occidentalism, because this one kind of helped me establish a theoretical framework and a way of having a dialogue with Western drama and Western comparative studies in terms of theories, right? So this book started with a kind of discussion of Tsai's Orientalism, in which he rightfully pointed out that when the Western people try to understand Oriental culture, instead of trying to represent the real Oriental cultures, people, or literature, they inevitably representing themselves the way they understand what the Orient to be. So Tsai's work was instrumental in making prominent the post-colonial study of theater and culture. And my Occidentalism, my first book, actually have a dialogue with Tsai by saying, if you look at a Chinese story and Chinese historical and cultural ideological circumstances, when the Western ideas and Western theater were introduced, they are not necessarily all imperialistic Western imposing their ideas and interpretation of Chinese culture. Mm-hmm. I especially studied the early post-Mao China, when Mao's ideology, the cultural revolutionary experience was challenged. The introduction of Shakespeare, introduction of Brecht's plays into the Chinese stage was a production adaptation of Western theater, but the reason they became popular or they became successful performances is because it provides something politically liberating for Chinese intellectuals and artists who are engaged in theater. Just give a brief example, Brecht's play, Galileo, about this scientist, was really relatable to the Chinese intellectuals and scientists who were persecuted during the Cultural Revolution. So Galileo's rejection or resistance to authority for them is a hero that they can follow to challenge the status quo, the ruling ideology, right? So that's why Braque's Galileo was so famous. So that's my first book, to really look at the cross-cultural conflict and contradictions and paradox when you study Chinese theater cross-culturally. My second book, Acting the Right Part, is really argue the central argument that Chinese theater in the PRC, in the People's Republic of China, which was established in 1949 and is still going on, we call it PRC. Chinese theater in the PRC period are politically driven, therefore not artistically worth studying. My main argument is you cannot really separate politics in everyday life, especially political life in China, from the theatrical impulses and performance in everyday life, in the sense that theater is political and everyday life is as theoretical events as what has been portrayed on theater. In order to advance this argument, I pick up a difficult period, that is the Cultural Revolutionary Model Theater. During the Cultural Revolution, the radical cultural figures promoted what is known as the eight model theaters of the Cultural Revolution to show those are exemplary proletarian theater we should pursue against the bourgeois theater that was criticized during the Cultural Revolution, including all the theater pieces written and performed by Tian Han, Hong Shen, and Ouyang Yuqian, and all the earlier dramatists. So I focus on model theater of the PRC to show even this extremely politically driven theater is in fact rooted in the rich artistic traditions of China and the West. For instance, among the eight model plays, five of them were in the dramatic form of Peking opera, right? Mm-hmm. When you have opera as a form, it is actually digging into the richest form of Peking opera. And then there is a Western ballet, two Western ballets, which is Western form that was supposed to be criticized during the Cultural Revolution, but they put into the revolutionary content. So there's a perfect combination of Western ballet art with the political content that was promoted during the Cultural Revolution. And then there's a Western symphony, which is a Western art form that was adapted with revolution theme and war stories. So, what I try to do in Acting the Right Part, my second book, is to really dig into the rich topics and traditions of Maoist theater or the theater of the PRC period in order to emphasize the importance of studying it. Very quickly, I'm going to my third book, that is Staging the Chinese Revolution. Andy, thank you for having an earlier podcast on this.
Yeah, if our listeners want to learn more about that book, they should listen to that earlier interview that we did. Yeah.
So I'm going to skip that, but you're asking how my current book is built on that. So very quickly, that one was about founding fathers of Chinese Communist Party, how they are portrayed from negative to positive in the case of Chen Duxiu, who was the real founder of the Chinese Communist Party in 21, and how Mao Zedong was performed in post-Mao China as someone who's attacking or criticizing corruption, which is aimed towards the rising problem corruption in the reform and Deng Xiaoping period. And I talk about the performance of Deng Xiaoping in theater, television, drama, and TV series, to show that it's a discrepancy. He was not just, as the official media said, a heroic leader in the 1920s military war. He actually fled from the battlefield in the crucial moment. This is by comparing different performance pieces and see what is not saying implicitly, but people who are into party and war history will interpret it that way. So this Staging the Chinese Revolution, my third book, is about founding fathers of Chinese Communist Party and the performances of their life stories in the difficult complex history of contemporary China. So my current book, the book we're talking about today, Performing a Chinese State, is a follow-up of my last book. Because the last book is about founding fathers of the Chinese Communist Party, and this one says, where does this tradition come from? It actually from the stories of founding fathers of Chinese theater, that is Shen, Tianhan, Ouyang Yuqian. And so that gave me a way of talking about the three key founders of modern Chinese theater and go back to history and illustrate how the Maoist theater and post-Mao theater was not a radical breaks from the early works of Tianhan, Hongshen, and Ouyang Yuqian in the Republic period before 1949. In fact, those three founding fathers of theater created and imagined the socialist theater and paved its way for its dominant appearance in the Maoist period, in the PRC period after 49.
So, ironically, because some of those founding fathers of Chinese theater fared quite poorly in that Maoist period. I'm thinking of Tianhan specifically here. Could you give us a little bit of a capsule biography of who he was and how his work influenced later work?
Yes, Tianhan, one of the three, or I would say first, founders of modern Chinese theater, is a really rich figure who studied in Japan in his early teens, late teens and early 20s, and fell in love with the Japanese introduction to Western theater. And he says, oh, this spoken drama stuff is really great. So he introduced the Japanese experimental theater that introduced the Western theater in the Japanese artist's rejection of Japanese traditional theater. And he said, this is what the Chinese dramatists could do. We introduce Western theater so we can reform. He didn't try to get rid of traditional Chinese theater. We can combine the Western theater with the traditional Chinese theater. So in this way, he's a little bit different from his Japanese peers. So in that sense, he was crucial in Western style theater, such as a spoken drama. He's also crucial in not rejecting traditional Chinese operatic tradition, but actually finding the best of it and try to combine it with Western style theater. So in my book, I kind of talk about the first play he actually wrote was in the form of traditional Chinese opera. That means not only he knows the tradition, he practiced that tradition and implanted into the revolutionary contemporary theme. He was also a writer of Western style opera. He also participated in the starting of film script, film industry. And most importantly, this is an influence that even today people see Tianhan's name mentioned all the time. He was the lyric writer of the Chinese national anthem that was written as a film theme song during the anti-Japanese war period or the Second World War period. And it became a national anthem in the PRC period and is still being seen today, especially when Chinese nationalist spirit were roused against US imperialism in recent trade war, right? So Tianhan is very famous because he's multidisciplinary and his achievement is cross-genre.
That's fantastic. So he's best remembered probably through that one song. Would you say that's correct?
Yes, National Anthem.
Yeah, well, yes, a very important song. Another figure you talk about is Hong Shen. Could you talk about his relationship to Tianhan? Were they colleagues, or was Hong Shen more somebody who followed in his footsteps?
Well, Hong Shen is definitely a colleague, not someone as a follower. But they have very different journey into the intellectual world. The most important thing is Tianhan studied in Japan and pick up Western theater and Western theater indirectly through his Japanese experience, through his contact and learning from Japanese artists. Well, Hong Shen went to Ohio State, where I taught for about 13 years, so it's especially endearing to me. And he was sent to the United States, or namely the Ohio State University, to study something that government thought was important in the 1920s. But he fell in love with theater, and he spent all his time in Columbus libraries reading Shakespeare and so on. So finally, he went to Harvard and enrolled in a very dramatic, very famous class that actually earlier trained very important American playwrights such as Eugene O'Neill. So he had this quintessential Harvard professional education in theater. And to top that, he also had theater experience. He worked in theaters in Boston and New York to be an usher, to take care of the coat of the audiences. So he learned all the managerial aspect of theater. Mm. So in that sense, he is he has the, what should I say, the advantage of learning American theater and by extension, Western theater, because the American theater produced a lot of classic Western plays such as Ibsen, Chekhov, and so on, and Shakespeare. Not only he has more classic education from Harvard about a tradition, but he also had hands-on experience in directing, theater management, and in that way, he is known in among the three founding fathers or in Chinese theater history as director, whereas Tian Han is a scriptwriter, even though both dovetail in both. But Tian Han is mostly a scriptwriter, an educator of some drama schools. But Hong Shen is celebrated as an all-rounded, real theater practitioner.
Did they ever collaborate together?
Yes, that's a very good question. Hong Shen returned to China after his internship from Boston and New York, because he was excited by the emerging theater activities that was going on in China. And he was invited by fellow theater artists, either in China or they received similar theater education in the West, to go back to China and really start a new modern drama theater tradition. So in both Tian Han and Hong Shen worked closely together, one as a scriptwriter, the other as a director. But Hong Shen himself is also an actor. So both of them are very very complex and has interdisciplinary or multidisciplinary training as theater practitioners. And both of them, interestingly, because they were very famous, they were leaders of theater and art and film. By the way, Hong Shen is even more involved in theater than Tian Han, because he also directed early films in addition to writing scripts as Tian Han and Ouyang Yuqian did for the film industry. So three founding fathers, you can also say, are also three key players in study Chinese film industry. But the other point I want to mention is both Hong Shen and Tian Han, because of the leadership before 1949 in the Republican period, they were promoted as key leaders in the PRC period. So the carry forward from the Republican period to the PRC, the key dramatic practices and management and the tradition into the socialist period, and their influence can still be seen in post-socialist period, because their dramatic pieces, television dramas and film are portraying their life as a theater artist and a successful ones, of course.
So are you saying that in a way there's more continuity between the pre-revolutionary Chinese theater and the post-revolutionary Chinese theater than people typically think?
Exactly. I'm so glad, Andy, you got that key point. That is to say, all my books from Occidentalism to this one, the argument at the back of my mind is to say Chinese theater is regarded, especially in the modern period, especially the Maoist period after 1949, were regarded as not art, right? Mm-hmm. It's just political maneuvering, propaganda pieces not worth studying. I'm saying you cannot really separate the dramatic tradition or the artist career from the Republican period to the PRC and post-Mao period. You can see a kind of continuity going through from the 1920s all the way to 1990s, because the dramatic tradition they created is a kind of glue that continues the dramatic art from the early 20s to 1949, which is the Republican period, and from 1949 to 1976, which is the high Mao socialist period and period of a Cultural Revolution, and all the way to the Deng Xiaoping period of economic reform, which started in 1980s. So I'm trying to talk about Chinese theater, not something uniquely politically oppressive, mm-hmm. not theater artists are mere victims, they're also creators and imaginaries of the socialist tradition. Without their early contributions of founding fathers of modern Chinese theater, we cannot really understand the Maoist theater and the post-Mao theater and the cultural traditions interwoven into them.
Do you think part of this misconception that thinks that, you know, Chinese theater artists are just sort of performing at the will of political masters, do you feel like that partially what people are doing is kind of projecting what they think is true about contemporary China onto China of 50, 60, 70 years ago?
I think you're quite right, because people have little knowledge or fewer knowledge or less knowledge of the Republican period drama from the 1920s to 1949, right? Mm-hmm. Because spoken drama was still being created by these founding fathers and was not became a popular genre until the Second World War period, when the Japanese invasion of China in the 1930s really motivated the dramatic production and popularized modern spoken drama as an important weapon in the battle against Japanese imperialism. So that piece is not as well known as the PRC cultural history, which is Maoist suppression of the intellectuals. We all heard a story that Tian Han didn't survive the Cultural Revolution. Therefore, the great artists who produced in the Republican period as successful dramatists could not survive the really rigid political oppression of the Maoist period, and especially during the Cultural Revolutionary period. To some extent, this argument is not wrong. But what I'm trying to say is to emphasize the continuity rather than the disruption between different periods, and to connect the earlier career with the later career, and to see one cannot be understood without the other. There's something passionate in Tian Han, Hong Shen, and to some extent in Ouyang Yuqian about social equality, mm-hmm. Writing and performing for the ordinary people, not for the aristocratic, and fighting against foreign invasion. That includes the Japanese, the American, and the European countries that invaded China in 1900. The all kinds of thematic concerns and artistic tradition that was started before 1949, and they get developed and evolved in the later periods.
I happen to have been reading some Mayakovsky this week, and it strikes me listening to you talk about Tian Han that you can almost think of him as like a Chinese parallel to Mayakovsky, that he's not somebody who is a victim of communism in a simplistic way, but he was somebody who really would have thought of himself as a writer for the people and as a dedicated, you know, sort of worker of the pen for the cause of socialism. Do you think that's fair?
Very fair. I think what you describe is can easily be applied to Tian Han, that in his early works in the 1920s, for example, he wrote a lot of plays about poor workers. Mm-hmm. And he also borrowed a lot of global socialist thought, Japanese socialism, and American individualism and transcendentalism, all these Western goodies. And he was influenced. He was reading widely about this. So theater for the people was a Russian trend, right? It was mm-hmm. also a global socialist trend. It was also Japanese socialist theater's belief, right? So this idea of theater has a function to meet the needs of the people, to describe the inequality of society, to describe what was known in socialist ideology as a class struggle, which was a global socialist trend in the 1920s and 30s, right? So this has less to do with Chinese Marxism, which Tianhai also switched to later, but that was after he turned left in the 1930s, right? So in the sense, Tianhai was not alone. He was among all these writers in the early 20s and who was sympathetic to the people, who were spokesmen of the people, and that make his transition into socialist artists an easy one if he did not create it and imagine and manufacture that kind of thing himself together with his peer artists.
Very and in good. A way that makes his fate in the 1960s even more tragic in a sense.
Exactly. Well, people, I would agree with this point that he was persecuted to death during the Cultural Revolution, and he was a victim of the Cultural Revolution. But people tend to forget how he was elected or appointed in 1949 as the president of as the Chinese Dramatists Association. He was the key leader by 1949 in early PRC period as a leader of theater and art, right? So he established a lot of socialist practice of theater, both in film, in television, and in theater and popular art and traditional Peking opera. So yes, he was a victim of Cultural Revolution, but I would also say, maybe emphasize even more, he's a victim of his own success.
Mm.
He was a successful people's artist before 1949. He was a key leader in the Maoist period. And precisely because he was responsible for all this artistic achievement from the Republican China all the way to the Cultural Revolution, when all these bad cultures were criticized during the Cultural Revolution as bourgeois feudalist art, Tianhai, of course, was the quintessential leader to be criticized. But why? Because he was also so successful in creating the Republican theater, the PRC theater. So he's also a victim of his success as a drama artist.
Well, Dr. Xiaomei Chen, thank you so much for talking with us about your wonderful book, Performing the Socialist State. I hope you've given our, I believe you've given our listeners enough of a taste for these fascinating characters that they'll want to run out and read the book for themselves. So thank you so much for being on New Books in Performing Arts once again to talk about 20th century Chinese drama.
Thank you very much, Andy, for giving me this opportunity to talk about my new book. I really appreciate it.